the women would just get all their instructions from the head of the house, you know. And the literal one, and the interpretation of scripture, had no graven images around them. So you didn't allow no photographs in the house of anybody, and no idols, interpretive idols, or dolls. See, trying to see in at this young man, and so they were all clamoring because they knew that he could heal people, clamoring to get in, and the meeting was starting, and he just got up and started to address the crowd. He turned around and he motioned for me to come over to him, and he told me to go down on Vine Street. And he reached in his pocket and got out a $20 bill. He said, "You take this," and said, "You go down on Vine Street." I forget the address now. They said, "You go upstairs." He said, "You go to apartment 2, I think it was now. Apartment 2. And he said, "You go in there." He said, "There'll be a little lady in there." And so she'll be in a rocking chair, and she's going to have her Bible clutched to her chest, and the room will be dark, and she'll be looking out this window. She's going there and you give her this $20. Tell her that somebody in this world does love her and does care about her. I went there, and just like you said, went up upstairs, knocked on the door, and it was a door, and it come on open, and there's that little lady in that chair, just like you described her, with that Bible cut chair. And when I told her that, she took tears, she rolled down her cheek, and she gave me a kiss on her cheek and told me that she said, "Thank you. You don't know how much that means to me." Or just things like that, but you know that. When you think of that, of all that big crowd there, and yet his mind is clear to that one moment person that really needed something for that. You think, you know, if there was any ego in it, there would have been taken up and maybe cut or hit or cut me into a boy of me, you know,
go.
A lot of things throw at him. I remember one time at a Cato Tabernacle in Indianapolis, we had a big convention there, and he was the our church was the sponsoring church, and the guest speaker was Bill Branham, which is a hot hand healer out of Southern Indiana, Jeffersonville. And he was supposed to have some sort of a gift to be able to call people out, but the things that he'd done that he was caught at, Jim, he said, he told, you know, he would make it out to the front people out there that just whatever the Lord laid on people's heart to give him, that's what he said. But his son, which was his business manager, told us exactly how much money had to go. After he got there, of course, and all the people was there. And so, but they done crap. You'd heard Jim talk about up in the minister's breakfast at the Lincoln Hotel. One of them got up and said that he'd sell a sucker list for $5. That meant people around the United States was ignorant to a lot of facts and susceptible to the religious people, you know, and they would ask they would be easy marks for him to give money to. And Jim said, you better stop. He said, stop that. I'll have no part of this. And they were discussing that morning where the next convention would be. He said, I'll not host it no more. But in...
He made a point. He has to go, but I need
it. But during that convention, people knew it was funny. Jim would get up and things would start to take place in his mind, you know, of this gift and such. And he said, I've done Branham, you know, right there at a moment. But he would act so Billy could have his time, you know, there. But Jim would just meet the needs that was very pressing that could be very, you know, could have been the death of somebody if he didn't take care of them. But I never will forget. I don't know whether she was a plant or whether the poor simple thing was really attracted, but she was in a real tight satin dress, and she come wiggling and squirming right up the aisle, you know, and tried to make some overtures at Jim, you know. And he looked at her with very stern eyes, and he said, sit down, sister, you're out of order. But I mean, it was a another thing that here you have, I think that seated about 7,000 people.
In this
tabernacle, you know. And here is a young man, as at any other young man at that time in life, you know, at that age, had been very affected by the crowd, by the eager attraction that was taking place there for them, but yet wasn't sidetracked a bit, had time to recognize what was going on right at that moment and take care of it, you know what I'm saying? But always been of the highest character in all of these situations.
What is the name of that place you preached at, you just mentioned?
Cadle Tabernacle. C-A-D-L-E.
Where is it located?
It was at Ohio and Delaware, I think.
And which city?
Ohio Street in Indianapolis, Indiana. I may have the cross streets
did
wrong.
Did you do that a lot? Did you preach to that place?
No, they just had a convention there in Indianapolis. But it was E. Howard Cadle was the founder of the place, and it was kind of a landmark. They broadcast every morning at 6 o'clock all over. They went from the East Coast.
These conventions had a lot of different healers and so forth. And
a lot of different. Big time
evangelists.
Yeah, out of the Assemblies of God, the Latter Rain Movement,
and they would come on
independent.
They would come on at different times during the day.
Oh yes.
They would come to hear different.
Yeah, they'd have different seminars. Some of them was good on this and all different aspects of religious.
Jim hosted one of these.
Yes.
What does that mean? It was he organized it, or?
And no, they had to have a host church to come into town, and he just. He was trying to affect, if I know anything, trying to affect people that, well, you got to look at this. People are usually very radical about their religion. And if you could get that kind of determination hooked to socialism, you'd have a hell of a socialism, you know. If you could develop that same kind of conscience that they had invested in friggin' religion, you know, it would be fabulous. And I think he worked to that end until he finally gave up on it, you know.
His original idea was then to use religion to get a lot of people behind the social gospel, and then...
Yes, because most of the religious people were the working class people,
yeah.
You know, and
but it didn't work out the way he wanted it to work out in Indiana, so he had to move.
No, that's right. Place. Now,
human race is a disappointment to
him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, one of the things that Ravina brought up a while ago, He was asking about the hate and things. It was back there in Indiana.
Someone got to make harm things, and how do you hear that people pray that you'll die 24 hours? 900 people pray that you'll die 24 hours around the
But clock. He had spoke about the paper idol.
The Bible. In his own church?
Well, and on the radio. And so there was a really concentrated effort towards him, and people would call up and tell him, but how's it feel to know that right at this moment, Jim Jones, there's 900 people praying for your death? I would say that that's quite a bit of a hate movement, wouldn't you?
Quite a bit. And the people got off, they didn't people hear it. The people are here now. I mean, didn't you get the house?
I told him about people ordering coal and that ship sending it.
Yeah, they call a cab, have a cab come out. I remember when I was big tonight, near Green Valley Street, there was a black family that moved in a neighborhood, a pretty nice neighborhood. It was white neighborhood, and neighborhood. But I don't get the name of it. Specific tears or something, but they had a crossbow in their yard one night, and people threw paint on their hats, something they read on the sandstone, they called him communist. So that somehow it came to him, he was the mayor of the mayor's commission for human rights, right?
Yeah.
They came to him and complained that these people couldn't get any peace, the children couldn't go to school safely. So Jim asked him when they're in a church to make a cake. And he said, I'm going to take a cake and make it down to the neighbor. And talk to them, you know, when they were so white and they were so hateful to these black people. And they moved in, and people from all over the world said, well, we can try. And he said, I'll go with you, I'll take it myself. So they took the cake, it was all nice, and I just took it over to the house. He knocked on the door, and he said, I wanted to talk to you. He said, your neighbors had moved in. He said, they wanted to give you a cake and talk to you a little bit. And the woman opened the screen door and took the cake and shoved it right in his face.
In his face?
Yeah. Rape issues and the paper aisle was a big thing. When you touch their sacred cow, there's nobody meaner than a religious person, a religious fanatic, or a racist. He was afraid to get a house, but then he was for a convict home.
Yeah.
And he got this house, and the man found out that he was going to have black people in there, and he refused to let him have it. And so Jim went over to him and talked to him. He said, you know, I'm going to help people, and the people who have nothing. And I remember all this, I remember the thing happening. And the man said, I've worked all my life, every goddamn thing I've got, and that's my house, there'll be a new nigga, whatever.
But he was going to, he said, I've planned everything around my retirement, and he said, I'd want a bunch of niggers tearing that up, and then me getting it back later. And the next day,
he said,
so you're going to sit in that big lounge chair.
He's going to sit in a big lounge chair. I'm going to relax. And he said, I've planned it. And he said, no neighbors coming in. He said, I'm going to sit in that lounge chair. And
the next day, that guy had a stroke, and he never moved a muscle from then on.
But he sent for Jim. If he sent for Jim to come over to his house, that man never moved a muscle. And Jim said, he looked at him. He could see his eyes. The man. He never had a day to live in the house. He never had a day to sit in that chair. But he refused black people the right to go there. But Jim said that they...
Now, hung open on one side, and then just kind of slobbered down one side, and he could look. Jim said he could tell. He was trying to repent 1,000 times for what, you know, and nothing. He'd stepped over that line, you know.
He was Pete's husband. Anybody was Pete's husband? He lived in the
Roy Johnson. Roy Johnson. I worked with that guy back in that Parsons I told you on 15th in New Jersey, where they planted the bomb in the coal. But anyhow, Earl helped me steamroll all the wallpaper off of that in there. But he hated black people. And he hated them. And we could be working along, and then if some of our black people would come in, he'd get off the damn ladder and get his shirt on and go home. He was a guy with high blood pressure. So Jim would talk to him, you know, and God damn, he'd have to get over this.
Miserable for Eva to even come to church, and he was so cruel to her because she wanted to come to church. She was a nasty bastard. And Jim had made said to Eva one day that, didn't he send someone back and tell Earl, he said, Earl, you have some socks in a drawer. He described the stripes on them and how many. He said, you must repent. You must change your attitude. You must, you know, get over this constant badgering Negro people, calling them niggers, and the treatment you're giving to your wife because she wants to come to the fellowship. He said that before you ever put those socks on again, you will be dead. He said, I don't want that. He said, don't you understand? I care about you. He said, for your own concern, he said, try to feel how it feels to be black. Try to think what it's like to have a black. And he pleaded with him. He begged him. He sent us back to talk to him. Nothing. He couldn't approach the man. He was just a goddamn racist. He wanted all niggers dead. He said that they couldn't kill them all enough for him. He didn't care that black babies was used to babies. He didn't care. He didn't care. He said that niggers were not human. They were not human.
Oh.
And he said to Eva, he said, you have a flower in your kitchen. He said, you have a flower in your kitchen. She tried to come to church, and I don't know whether he beat her, but she came and just broken that night. But she came. You could see she was just tormented over it. And he said, before the flower blooms, so it'll be a white flower. He said, you will be alone. But for a short while, her mother died. And at the wake, she was standing at the casket. She said, is this it, Jim? He said, it is not what I meant. No. And Earl died shortly after that. And when that flower bloomed, she brought it into the church and had a white flower on it. He died one day and the flower bloomed, what, a day later? So maybe that enough haste to even keep a flower blooming, I don't know.
John Hood used to come to the ranch very often to see us and try to gain some access to people's temple. I personally was reluctant to encourage him, mostly because he was so close to the Stricklands. And one of the patients who got to be very hostile to all of us because he was annoyed the Stricklands hadn't. He felt deserted him and left him on the ranch and not given him an appropriate situation living outside. Anyway, John, I used to come quite frequently, and we'd have brief talks, and it would always lead to the possibility of getting close to the church group and talking to Jim again. But he told me a story which interested me. He said that the first time he met Jim, he was walking down behind the house, the house behind the church. There was a little river there, a little water flow and a railroad track. He said he was coming across that field, and one of the dogs he assumed was one of ours, or one belonging to the church, had barked and yelled and approached him and eventually bit him on the leg. And he went to feel his leg, you know, to see just what kind of damage he had. There was a little blood coming from there. He had a kind of a scratch or something. But he looked up and he saw Jim coming down. And Jim said, what happened? And he said, well, I think the dog has bit me, and I'm just trying to fix my, you know, do something about it. He said, come with me to the house. So he said he went to the house, and Jim took him inside and got a Band-Aid and put it on his leg. You know, put some medication, I don't know, with a Band-Aid. And he said that
he was treated so gently and so kindly. He said when he went home, he said there wasn't anything there. It was all gone. There was nothing there. And he knows he had a bruise or a bleeding situation on his leg. And he said he was so impressed by that. He said he couldn't resist ever trying whenever possible to get close to Jim again, to try to communicate with him, to talk to him, or join the group and be part of the whole overall effort. But I felt that, and several people did, that he was much too close to the Stricklands, and the Stricklands were most hostile to the rest of us.
Everybody in River Valley, we stopped the service to go
say I'm losing my grapes, so, I can't get no pickers, and we go out and pick a whole bunch of grapes, you know, and send them in, and Thomas was touched for that, you know, that guy that lived next door there to our property there, Thomas, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's a guy who owned all the pear trees.
Yeah.
We're doing that down at Cooper House. Jim had a helper, and one of the kids had an accident. We even had he told us to patronize her business and all this and that. And she turned out to be a atrocious enemy.
Yeah. Pure woman you ever seen. And her husband was a drunk Cooper Trucking Company there in Ukiah. And he was a drunk. And, I mean, he would treat her like a dog. And we helped her. A lot of counseling, a lot of personal situations that Patty and a lot of the ladies done for her, you know, and boy, then she turned like a dog on us. I still think it was Grace. She was a blonde.
That's the time about Kathy Hunter. Remember when she... Are you talking about the son? She always calls him. She always wants personal. She always had to talk. You know, give her time, or if she needs some of this. And the other one was Dr. Vest.
Yeah.
He ran ass off of him. Well, Dr. Vest had he was a doctor in Utah.
He's my doctor.
So he had an accident. A tractor fell on him or something.
Well, turned over backwards on him and broke his pelvis.
And they were a very close family. And the wife and a lot of children, and when this happened, we went over to the house, we took food, she's the mother never helped her like that, nobody, we carried food, we went to the hospital, we took food, we did everything, and he was unconscious for 5 days, is that right?
Yeah.
And two of the doctors were in the room, and he wasn't even conscious yet, and Jim said on the phone, they were talking to somebody, it's Marston. He said, I think I'll go see Dr. Vest tomorrow at 2:20. And I said, well, you know, why 2:20? He said, I just think I'll go at 2:20. He said, I feel that would be the right time to go. He walked into the room. Dr. Vest opened his eyes as a witness of the nurse and Mrs. Vest. I know what Chip said now, but back then. And he spoke to Jim. And when Jim walked away from the room, a rainbow appeared in the sky, and the nurse called the attention of Mrs. Vest. Look at the rainbow.
And you've been unconscious until
that. 5 days. And I imagine now they, you know, I'm sure they went the way of all people.
Do you remember any people in Redwood Valley, Ukiah, that you recall who were racist, who were Jim got to him and changed him in some way.
What about Head? What's his name?
Teddy. People that Jim was able to get to, would he ever make any in those?
I think he did a little bit with Teddy, but I don't know now.
You haven't heard from
him. I don't know of any, but Tom Kite.
What was Tom like before? Do you know anything about
it? I think, well, he didn't read his paper or what he was. But I'm sure that he was just like every other redneck down there at Masonite, you know. Okay, well, let's see. Who else was it?
Don't have your bread. Married a black man. And Jack was in, and all of us were totally supporting. They tried to burn your house down or something one night. Just put, had, heard a whole bunch of leaves cracking out in the night.
Not during the day.
And she wanted to marry that.
Cobb?
Yeah. She wanted to marry Cobb. You know, just people across the street, I don't know. They took my car and shoved it down the hill. Wrote a note to me after never part of going to the house again. There's no reason. There's no logic to the reason.
Yeah, because Jim come there and called on Joyce.
They knew
us. We lived there. I had a nursing home there.
That's right.
Yeah, they set it on fire. So I set the thing on. We had to go. Well, we wouldn't set our own house on fire. We're sure of it.
Well, they're the ones. I'd come to visit and park my car, and they'd move it down the street and leave a note: "Don't ever park here again." Well, they'd go to work, and he had some, this man had some kind of a foreman. At Mason, and he's torment, like, you know, Walter's from Kentucky, and he's all that nigger preacher of yours, Walter. And of course, Walter wanted to break both their legs and their arm, and only Jim's love kept us. You feel so full, often, you know, you're sleeping at night, and you hear all these screams and sounds, nigger, communist nigger lover.
That was in Ukiah. That they've done a job on all of us. Call you up all every 5 minutes on the goddamn phone.
Oh, a lot of people in the church.
Say, you nigger loving son of a bitch, get out of town.
Crazy stuff, you know, weird, sick kind of shit. We wonder now, where are all the doctors at? And where are all the people that he helped? Young people, you go to jails and places and he's having to go to jail to talk to people and bail people out. I wonder where they all are.
You talk about jail. I went down to jail. Jim had talked to this young Martindale kid there in Indianapolis. And he was a... You couldn't tell him anything. He was... And Jim had warned him, said, don't do what you're doing. You're going to get in trouble. And he thought, evidently it was stealing or something. He didn't betray his confidence and say it outright, but he did. But anyhow, he said, do you know how it is to be in jail? He said, I've had to go down to jails and deal with people down there. And he said, you're young, and you're petite in structure. You know, he wasn't a big kid. He said, you're kind of effeminate. And he said, they'll mutilate you in jail if you get put in jail. And I went down to see him. And this kid had been raped, and his asshole was turned inside out, where they just brutalized this guy. Left him in the ass, so blood was running down his legs on both sides. Tore him up. And but Jim got him out. And that, then people they said bad things about him. You know?
Did Anita Kelly? Did Anita Mike Kelly? When he got a job in Georgia Pacific, that time they were both living at the ranch. I believe when he first got into that job, or just after, in any event, he would meet, he would have to go to socials with the group, and I think he strategized the way of doing it without introducing Anita as his wife or bringing her along. She often had to drive, and I believe she used to leave him just prior to his reaching where he would meet other workers there. And, that's always struck me as a little dubious of him, you know. He went to many socials, many occasions, as I recall, but he arranged it so that Anita wouldn't participate.
Jack, remember Edith Cordell? And we were getting ready to come to California, and her daughter But they stole all of you.
Yeah, we got that.
I was in church at morning, and she was so hopeful because her mother was coming out. Well, and she got up to walk out of church, and she took a fist like that. She shook it in Jim's face.
He's terrible.
You're on the court.
I was
talking about coming out here, and she knew her mother was going to come out, and she didn't want her mother to come. She wouldn't get property, house, nothing, you know. Wasn't that it? And Jim said, Charlie said, don't leave the church at hospital. He said, don't do that. He said, don't walk out of here with so much hate. He said, it's only going to react on you. And he said, I don't want that. He said, if there's something you don't understand, he said, if you don't understand why we want to live with some peace or children, he said, come up and talk to me, but don't walk out of here like that. Carol walked out of church, and he just stopped. He just looked out, and he said, I wouldn't be hurt for $10,000. When she went home, and she was so filled with hate, she was so vexed and hostile. She took, I don't know how many, 60 sleeping pills, and they didn't find her for, normally, for her to even come back, woke up, she would be retarded due to lack of oxygen in the brain, as I understand it. But the husband didn't find her, and when they found her, then Edith, the mother, called Jim. And what happened about that, Jack? Then Jim, he said he knew Edith couldn't stand if anything happened to that daughter, even though the daughter was a racist bitch. She said, please, and he said, she'll be all right. He said, I give you my word, she will be all right. She came back, and she was one of the worst enemies we ever had.
Wow.
She,
yeah.
She hated black people, hated their guts, despised them. She thought they ought to all be. I was told her one day I knew that situation with a man hung on a tree. She said they should. She didn't know why we ever had him here in the first place. And the fact her mother was going to come to California, we were living in an integrated group more than we did in Indianapolis. And I knew there was a case of a girl with change. She's adopted a black baby. She's married to a black man and has a little black baby. Not my wife had a baby, but she adopted the baby. That's what she wanted to do. She was a real racist bitch. I think she could have killed you. And she had enough hatred to kill you. I think what she meant today when she left you, that her own hatred would destroy her. She tried to destroy herself.
Why did she come out to California?
What do you think was her real reason?
She's married to that...
I think after she come back from that death situation, that brought her thinking around. And but McCoy, that guy that she was married to, he was a racist from out in Brightwood.
Yeah.
There in Indianapolis, and you just look at that dude. He was a knothead. He was a knothead redneck, and she was having a struggle between those two worlds, you know. But I think he cared about her, and he figured probably get out here, and it'd work out for a little while, and then. You know, he'd get her back, and they'd go on back there. But it didn't. She had to get rid of him because he didn't want to give up his racism. That's what it was.
She came into the service. I do not recall her name.
I'm sorry.
She came into the service. She's a very religious woman. And Jim said, he was talking, and he stopped and looked at her, and he greeted her into the service and welcomed her. And he said, I'm concerned about a female condition. He said, you know you have, don't you? She said, yes. She began to cry. And he said, your racism, your situation that you're living in has had an effect on your health. But he said, they're coming. And it's kind of like, you know, in the scripture it said, come and learn of me, for I'm easy and take my yoke. It's not that heavy. And she said that. He said that. He said, I'm concerned, he said, about, you know, your health. And he said that He said, what did he tell her, Jack? He said he'd give her the word that was learning, that she had to change her, she had to overcome her race hatred, and her health could be restored. If she could overcome the ingrown hatred that she felt. And she said, she cried. I think she was sincerely touched. She went home, and her husband forbid her to come. She called, crying and sobbing. And she asked me to talk to her husband. He forbid her to come. And I called him back. And I said, your wife, I said that, you know, I said that she's been ill. And I said that we're concerned about her. And I said, the pastor's told her to come back. And she can work. And I tried to be very loving with him. Jim told me to be very loving. And I said, you know, her health was depending on her outlook. And he said, I would rather that she died with cancer than to come to that group. And so she did. So I was about moving to Indianapolis. And it was really crazy. You know, his job and my money and it all meant something to me. And so we packed our bags and everything. And I said, well, let's just move to Indianapolis. I said, you can get a job. And I said, it'll work out great. And Marshall and Jim were already in California. And I wanted to go to California, so packed our dog and our kids and everything in a trailer. And my mother said to me, she said, what if Walter don't like the... She said, you don't want to go to California. I said, I won't tell him to go. She said, well, how are you going to do it? I said, I don't know. I said, we'll get as far as Indianapolis. And I said, I don't like it here. We'll just keep right on going. That's what we did.
16.
What?
The time in the morning at 3:16, he said, 3:09 on the 16th, and we were in a room in there, and people was talking there, you know, and he just stopped everybody, and he said that he had a, I guess like a vision, he saw it, you know, he was looking out the window, and he said that there would be a Holocaust. 3:09 on the 16th, and it'd be in November, I'm pretty sure, because he saw a pear on a tree, and that was very awesome, you know, when you think back, to give significance to that, since the time, and you take notice on the 16th, something significant has always happened ever since that.
Wow. They said to Jim, even when she said Jim, she's going to die. She said she is not going to die. I said she will not die. In the night of the accident on the 16th, we were in Golden Rule Church, and I was in an argument with Al Cheddar. We were not all about attention. I thought at the time I was justified. I thought he was being an ass. I'm sure this time he thought I was an ass. We were fighting, and Jim, this is the goal. We were most people left. This was on 15th. And this is after this policy had been given. And Mary and Alan and Sarah, Gerald, and I don't know who all was in it, I don't know who they're not, were arguing. Jim came back. He said, where are you guys arguing? We just got out of a nice service. He said, we should do that. And I said, well, they're all good friends. And he said, I'm not the ball. And I said, well, and just when somebody came to the thing, they said, come quick, there's been a terrible accident. Rodney Freestone was a racist bastard. And his wife and their two children went off of the cliff to go home. And we all got in the car and drove there. And the reason I said about the argument, because I think, not that I don't mean that, you know, I caused the accident, I don't mean that, but I think that all the negativity Jim felt that this thing was in the offing. And maybe it was happening. He just felt that we didn't need that kind of negativity right at that time. And so when we got there, how far down would you say that drop was? Up the cliff.
Go ahead.
Down. Straight down. And we all, nobody really knew what to do. We were down there, but nobody knew what to do. And he took a flashlight. And we went down that mountain. It looked like an elevator going down the whole way. And we went down. They looked and carried up really good. he came back, and he came back up, and he talked to Faith, who was the other daughter, and she was crying, going on. He said, "Your mother,
what?
I'll never forget this." He said, "Your mother, and right here was her stepfather, and your sister Teresa will live." She said, "What about Belinda?" Belinda, that was the baby. She said, "Your mother, Whitey, and Teresa will live." She said, "But Jim, what about Belinda?" And he said, "It one more time." He said, "One more time." He said, "Your mother, and Teresa, and Whitey will live." And Belinda died. She came down to the hospital, and she was at the vegetable.
There was another prophecy that come true about that time. He said, there was a prophecy said, one, this is before it ever happened.
They worshiped
this one baby. Yeah. They worshiped the woman of the Lord, and Teresa, they had no respect for. She got up like 200 pounds at 12 years old. She felt very scared. Belinda was their idol. They adored, worshiped, cherished her. He said, "You've got to stop that." She was one publicly. She was chastised publicly about that.
But the prophecy come forward and said, one of you will die in the shadow of the mount of our protection, and one will be taken by ambulance and not returned. And at that time, just prior to that time, maybe a couple months, we had discovered a cave up there. And that's the mount or the area that the cave was that you would have no bottom in it, you know. And everybody said that there wasn't a cave up there. And Jim, that's another thing. Jim walked right up right straight to a cave up there. You could, on top of the ground, you had to go down in this way. But nobody knew that nobody's ever heard of it in that area. But it was there. And, but that was the prophecy that said, one will die in the shadow of the mount of our protection. They'll be taken away in an ambulance and not returned. But they took Belinda to the hospital that night after that accident. They took her in a car. They took her in an automobile to the hospital in Ukiah. Then they transferred into an ambulance and took her to Santa Rosa. She never came back.
After Belinda was taken, they began to give attention to Teresa, this other little girl. And she kind of flourished. And she would have done so beautiful, but she was molested by this stepfather, this Whitey Freestone. And he was a racist. He was a child molester. He molested his daughter, Faith. And I met Faith Kice, Faith whatever it was. We call her Faith. Well, I remember she couldn't walk. One girl may hold her so she could be balanced on each side. And I don't know what was wrong with her. She was in kind of a catatonic state, as I know now. But he took Vaseline and rubbed on her vagina. She was a little girl, and he put his peter in her and he kept it up. And she was traumatized. I don't think the mother ever accepted that he did that. The child was traumatized for that. And Jimmy Marshall spent hours with Faith talking.